When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Up on this episode of White Line Question Time.
And he was coach driver, and I mean he would be like doing up our kitchen or something. As when I was a kid, he'd be sort of redecorating, and I'd say to him, like, Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house? So it was sort of, you know, kind of, he'd been blessed with a camp child, what can I say? It took me a long time to have other queer friends, really, I think. When I was growing up, they weren't... I did feel like the only gay. Growing up, you sort of go... I'd meet people and I'd do, like, youth theatre things, or and I'd be like, oh, I bet they're all... Everyone will be gay here and I'll finally be at home. And no, no one was gay. And so... rather than... stand up to the bullies, was there was a school cabaret, and I decided to do Judy Walters' monologue from Alan Bennett's Talking Heads, which, if your listeners know it, where the character has found herself in a porn film without realising.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is an award-winning comedian who at 40 is finally edging ever closer to becoming the 46-year-old man he believes he's been trapped inside ever since he was a child. Critics have described him as one of our best comedy talents, whilst he describes himself as a peculiar, eccentric, sometimes very emotional, Patricia Routledge-obsessed loner who grew up speaking like a cast member of Downton Abbey and dressed like some kind of millionaire yacht owner, all despite being raised by very working-class parents in Bromley, in Kent. He's also, rather excitingly, Gloria Hunniford's cousin, something he discovered recently when he took part in ITV's DNA Journey. As well as his work as a stand-up, he also hosts The Apprentice You're Fired, co-hosts The Great British Bake Off and Extra Slice alongside Joe Brand, and is a regular on Celebrity Gogglebox, having found almost instant success on the comedy circuit after winning the BBC's New Comedy Award when he was just 22. But read either of his two books, both memoirs and both brilliant, and what you find is a man who writes with great depth, despite penning himself at times as being as shallow as a puddle, with a mix of witty self-deprecation that straddles, well, self-flagellation, all of which makes him as compelling on the page as he is on the stage, which is kind of where he's always wanted to be. In fact, his very earliest memory is of getting deliberately lost in the supermarket so he could hear his name being called out on a public address system. So let's give him what he wants, shall we, and dial him up. Tom Allen. How are you?
Kate, what a lovely introduction. I think no one's ever summed me up so well. I appreciate that. I'm very well today. I'm a little bit cold because we've got the cold weather, and I've been wrestling with my thermostat because I do not understand it, because it's a very modern one, but I don't know why it doesn't have levers and dials, and I prefer things when they're a bit more analog.
We're having a cold snap, Tom, aren't we? I
mean, we're having a cold snap.
The garden is still hard, and we're speaking at 10:20.
I know, exactly. And so I haven't planted my bulbs yet, so I don't think they're going to go in this year. No, that's it. That's done.
Although, it's given to brighten up. God, we sound like old people.
This is my world. Welcome. I've always... You mentioned I used to think I was 46 years old, but now I'm sort of approaching 46. I think I've been moving ahead. I think I'm about 86 now. So I just want to sit down quietly in a chair.
Do you feel like you're finally coming into your own, growing into the body that you've occupied forever mentally?
Yeah, I like it. I like the fact that I like being in my 40s now, because you don't have to apologize if you go, oh, do you know what? No, I don't want to do that. Do you want to come to this party? No. It's quite nice when you're in your 40s and you just sit around quietly watching Miss Marple maybe. And thinking about the garden, thinking about something you might need to do, maybe bleeding radiators, that kind of thing, suits me fine.
You love it, don't you? Are you a big fan of interiors, which is odd for a man that was almost 40 by the time he owned his first home?
I lived at my parents' house for a long time, and then I've moved to round the corner from them, and I am obsessed with interiors. When I moved into the house, it's you can see it around me now, it's very grey. But I'm trying to put more colour into it. So I'm getting more ambitious and trying to make it seem... I'm not from a posh background at all. My dad was a coach driver. But I've got aspirations of making it seem like a stately home, which is borders on tacky.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Is it... Please tell me you're not going to stuff it with things like fountains that light up and fake pillars.
Give me half a chance and I will. Well, I've already got an urn in the garden. Just as we were getting ready, I showed you, Kate, didn't I? The back garden. I bought an urn for the garden and I didn't realise how big it was. I bought it online, which apparently is the way to do things. And it is about 2 metres tall and therefore makes my not that big garden look like a sort of Parisian cemetery.
I like that. Rather than just a cemetery, you inserted Parisian. That's nice.
Oh, yeah. Still fabulous. Yeah, still fabulous. But very, very maudlin, to use your word. It's sort of got a grandiosity about it, which really only suits the deceased.
Listen, you say you're not from a fancy family, but recent discoveries would prove, well, that if not fancy, fascinating. Gloria Hunniford's cousin. Shut up.
Well, I can't believe that. I couldn't believe it at the time. And I don't want anyone to think I'm some sort of nepo baby. It's only in my recent life that I've... I had this connection established. In fact, I need to work out. She's about fifth cousin, I think, in Ireland. My mum's family are all Irish, so it's along those lines. But I assumed it was across my grandfather's side because he's from Northern Ireland and like her. But I think it might be my grandmother who's from Mayo in the south.
How excited were you when you discovered that?
I mean, you know, these programs, other people like Danny Dyer was related to Richard III and Josh Widdicombe was a Plantagenet or something. And I thought how absolutely typical that it would be that I'm related to one of the hosts of Rip Off Britain. And I think at one point, Pebble Mill, I think she was once on Pebble Mill, Gloria.
But Gloria's story is really quite something, actually. I did her life story for Radio 2 many years ago.
Oh, did you, Kate?
Yeah, and you know what? She is a late starter. So she was roughly the age you are now when she became well-known. And prior to that, she was a housewife who did a bit of, like, she did Tupperware parties on the side. She was kind of a pillar of the community. And she literally hustled her way into broadcasting, became the face of Ulster television. She did, like, their equivalent of what would be The One Show. And then when opportunity knocked and she came to London, she passed the show to a young Eamon Holmes. And she came and she was the first woman on Radio 2. And she is the reason why there are women's toilets at Radio 2, because until she arrived, there was no need.
Isn't that extraordinary? I didn't know that. I didn't know about Radio 2 having so few female presenters on it. That's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, so few. There were none.
Yeah, because the thought was back in the day that women didn't want to hear... Women who were the audience at home wouldn't want to hear other women's voices. They would want the comfort of a male's voice whilst they missed their husbands.
Oh, my God. Isn't that extraordinary?
And that's actually in our lifetime, right? That's in living memory.
I was going to say, but that doesn't sound like that's that long ago, because when... I think Gloria moved over here in the 80s, was it?
Yeah.
So, oh, wow. Isn't that... I mean, yeah, that's not that long ago at all.
You need to get together with Gloria and ask her all these questions, because honestly, she is super fascinating.
She is wonderful, isn't she? When she came... Yes, so on the DNA show, she was presented as a surprise. Who's it going to be? And then she walked in. But the thing about her is she's such a... an old school broadcaster. As soon as she walked in front of the camera, she just started presenting the programme and started interviewing me.
That's what she does.
So, looking for an auto cue with some links on it. Yeah,
I went to number 10 with her one year. Oh. I know, which is really fancy, right? And she invited me. It was all to do with the Karen Keating trust that she runs. So in memory of her daughter, who I was lucky enough to know and work with. And Gloria is just remarkable. But even when we arrived at number 10 with the Prime Minister and his wife, she was still running the show. Like, she had it all. Yeah, I mean, she was like, so Kate wants to go and have a look at the wall cabinet. Is that okay? If she goes to the wall, she's like, okay, off you go, you go. And then I'll be back here. I mean, literally coordinating it all brilliantly. She's quite something.
She's fabulous, isn't she? And actually, she would be good at running the world, actually. She doesn't take any nonsense, that's for sure.
And she'd get you a good price on things. Issues with that.
The post office situation would have been resolved straight away.
Wouldn't it?
Can you imagine if she'd been in Mr. Bates's shoes? Oh, the post office.
Her and Angela.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah.
I can literally smell an ITV3 drama, can't you? The Gloria Hunniford stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love that.
So would I.
Oh, yeah. An anthology series, the Gloria Hunniford stories. Just different moments, yeah?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, lovely.
So you've got new relations. You've also got a relatively new relationship as well. You and Elfie, not only are you relatively newly together, but you're living together as well, Tom. I mean, in the deep
end. Yes, we're basically living together and it's lovely. In sin, as people are constantly shouting at us. It's very nice. It's nice to kind of be, well, since moving into this house, when I first moved in, I was on my own and I found it quite odd to be, because I'd lived at my parents for so long.
When you say so long, Tom, you were 37, weren't you, when you moved out?
Yes, I moved back home when I was about 30. So yeah. I moved out just at the sort of end of the pandemic. It was April of, what was that, 2021, I think. Mm. Yeah, so I was about, just coming up to 38. And it was kind of, sort of strange to suddenly have my own place, especially after that weird time of the pandemic, which I don't, no one really talks about the kind of fallout of that time. And when we were all sort of in this strange mental space and then suddenly like, oh, I'm in my own place, which I've saved up for so long. Just for the deposit, I still have a mortgage, I hasten to add. And then having Alf here has been very nice. Sort of makes it complete, really. So it's been, lovely, very nice. And he's quite good at emptying the dishwasher, does the ironing. We're very domesticated. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's nice. Because he's kind of your first serious long-term boyfriend, am I right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. It was almost like I was too weird for anybody before then.
Not true, and, surely. Just too fabulous, sorry.
Too fabulous, yes, that's what it was. Too weird. I quite liked, but I quite liked being on my own as well. Like when I was single, I kind of reveled in it in a way. I was like, yes, confirmed bachelor that I am. And that's...
You sound like Cliff Richard.
Yeah, I've always kind of liked the idea of something quite old fashioned. Yeah. And so it's kind of a surprise, really, when got together with Al. So it's been nice. It's been lovely, really lovely.
How did you meet?
Well, we met essentially doing a sort of TV run through, actually. So it's television that brought us together, and he was starting out, and I was starting out, and it turned out we live in the same area of Bromley, a small part of it, and so we were sort of neighbours, really. It was kind of like without realising.
So he's always been there.
He was just round the corner all along.
Wow!
So, isn't that not the boy next door, but the boy round the corner, round the bend. Yeah.
And how long had you known of each other?
So that was about 2016, I think. We've been friends, and then we've got together properly, sort of in the summer of 2020. 22? No, what year are we in? I don't know what year. 2021.
Don't end you of find 2021. The pandemic has completely screwed your ability to recall years.
Absolutely. I'm just suddenly going, is this 2020? Yeah. I still sort of think it's 2019, really.
So do I. And you know, you're so right. You just said something that is so pertinent, which is we never talk about the pandemic. It's a bit like don't talk about the war. And I understand why people didn't want to talk about the war, because it must have surely been, you know, the most horrific experience to live through, and for 7 years. But none of us sit and talk about those extraordinary 2 years. We don't get angry about it. I don't know. It's just odd, isn't it? The human condition is very strange.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it was so overwhelming, particularly at the beginning when we really didn't know anything about it, and we're like, "What, is everybody going to die? Is that how?" And part of me was thinking that. I mean, sounds bleak, but
yeah, I remember the very beginning of the pandemic, very beginning, when it, you know, I remember having to learn how to do podcasting from home and being sent an engineer to the house.
Yes.
Just in case. And we, you know, I listened back to some of the old episodes of the podcast, and I do like this disclaimer at the top going, just to let you know, this episode was recorded on the phone. Like, it's revolutionary.
And then
2 weeks before we went into lockdown, I was told to isolate because I was doing a show at Radio 5 and they had an Australian band in, and the lead singer had got coronavirus and had been hospitalised in Australia.
Oh,
so I was told to stay home. So the day that I was supposed to come out of my self-imposed isolation, the whole world went into lockdown and that was it. And I was like, blimey, it's probably going to be 4 weeks till I'm out now.
And they were, and that's what they were saying was like, if we stay at home, do you remember they were like, we can squash the peak of the numbers. So we just stay home for 3 weeks, I think it was going to be, wasn't it?
They didn't have a fucking clue what they were talking about. Who knew?
Absolutely none. Yeah, absolutely none. And I mean, we just all sort of got on with it, strangely. I mean, I suppose that's impressive, really. But
Isn't it? But also very shocking that we all very obediently, for the most part, did as we were told. I don't know that we would do that again.
I wonder now. Because back then we were just sort of like, yes, you've got to stay in, stay home, stop the spread, wash your hands.
Sing happy birthday.
Birthday when you wash your hands, yeah.
Bang a saucepan every Thursday at 8.
Bang a saucepan. Some of my mum and dad's neighbours would be out at sort of 5-2 and I'd be like, it's not time.
Yes. And a bit like Zola Budd, since the pandemic, I've never stopped walking. You know, prior to that, I'd never have considered going for a walk. But now it's religion for me. I walk every day.
Have you held
on to anything from the pandemic?
I try to hold on to the fact that I did yoga with Adrienne every day.
Did you?
During the pandemic. I would do like a sort of 10-minute yoga stretch, which was very good for the brain. But I haven't managed to completely sustain that. But I like the idea that I might have done.
There's a yogi in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In my mind, I'm
Namaste.
Namaste. In my mind, I'm Jane Fonda doing a workout. But in reality, I'm not.
That's my ambition, to live my dotage like Jane Fonda in one of those millionaire sort of retirement communities where apparently, check this out, there is staggering across the US, there is a huge spike in the number of STIs amongst pensioners in these communities. They're all just shagging.
Extraordinary,
amazing.
Isn't it? Extraordinary. What a life. What a way to go.
That's my future plan anyway, Tom. Back to the show.
It's good to have a retirement plan.
It's good to dream.
Now, if you didn't retire early, people would be like, we know why.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I've tried to devise three, I hope, thought-provoking questions, but actually, you're a man that made me think, because I've been listening to both of your memoirs on Audible, because I really think that there is so much to be gained from the phrasing and the delivery of your words.
Thank you.
I wanted to tap into the theme of the last book, which was too much. So can we dive into some of the moments in life where possibly that term could have prefixed, well, pretty much everything?
Sure. I'd love that, yeah.
First of all, I wanted to talk about how you felt you were too much for your dad, because you sadly lost your dad a couple of years back. And this book is kind of like a love letter to your dad, isn't it? Really?
Well, I was writing the book and then he died. And so I thought, well, I think you have to sort of be honest with your readers and offer them something and be vulnerable for them. Otherwise, what's the point of a book, you know? So I did write about that experience of losing someone. And I think with my dad, as I say, he was a coach driver and was from a working class background and grown up in Penge.
So Penge, so for people that don't know what Penge is, describe Penge, Tom.
Oh, yeah. He'd grown up in Penge. Does sound a bit sort of like, what, he'd grown up in what? Penge is an area of southeast London, which doesn't sound very... The sound of the place name isn't very appealing in itself. At Penge, it's sort of between Annerley, which also doesn't sound very nice, and...
Crystal Palace,
yeah, exactly. But it's sort of now, I think, a bit more she-she, but back then it wasn't. And he grew up there. And he was a coach driver. And I mean, he would be like doing up our kitchen or something. As when I was a kid, he'd be sort of redecorating. And I'd say to him, like, Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house? So it was sort of, you know, kind of, he'd been blessed with a camp child. What can I say?
You were the chalk to his cheese, yeah. Weren't you, in so many ways? But your love was strong for one another.
I think so, you know. And I think I was very lucky. I had very loving parents, and I think they, but yet I think there was a challenge that they had this kind of, as is often the case, your offspring turn out to be totally different to what you expected, and totally they're not necessarily the same as you. And I was definitely an example of that, and would kind of be very particular about things and very kind of worried about things all the time, and very kind of, you know, like taking library books out about Noel Coward was kind of quite distant from my dad, who'd sort of grown up playing football and going to the pub, and you know, like it was sort of a different world. But I was just sort of, they got out of nowhere this kind of flamboyant son
with a very clipped, well-spoken accent. They don't speak like you, do they?
No, they'd be like, I don't know where we got him from. Yeah, I don't know, it must have been something in the gas and air.
Because what's your brother like?
He's very normal, really, I suppose, is the only way to describe him. He's just a normal person, and isn't somebody who buys Parisian urns online. He works in construction. He's a tiler, and you know, just sort of gets on with his life. But yeah, so I think probably at school it was a bit like, oh, there's my brother. Yeah, but he's the one in the bow tie and the bowler hat. My brother just wanted to blend in with his mates.
Yes, I can imagine. But for your dad, did you ever sense that he struggled with who you are? Were you too much for him? Because you don't write it like that.
I think it was sometimes a surprise. I think the fact that I would be obsessed with like spending my birthday money on cutlery, or I think he just sometimes was perplexed by it. And I remember when he first took me to the pub as a later teenager, and he said, what do you want to drink, expecting me to say like half a lager or something, like a, you know, like a teenager might, and I said a gin and tonic. He went, oh no, you're too young for a gin and tonic, as though I'd walked into the pub and ordered a like pina colada with an umbrella in it, like gin and tonic was slightly too flamboyant for him. But I think that it was that sort of thing. And then my first job was working at the golf club he was a member of. And I was in charge of desserts on the Sunday lunch service. And I treated that dessert trolley like it was the trolley from Meet Me in St. Louis. You know, it was like... so kind of... It was very... I was just sort of full of flamboyance for it. And I think that was a lot for the golf club. But they seemed to sort of like it. What I realised in my teenage years as well is... And my dad taught me this, is if the world takes you at your own valuation. So if you apologize for yourself, people will be like, oh, look at this person. They don't believe in themselves. I've got no connection with them. But if you go, look, I'm this big personality. Then people will go, oh yeah, I like him. He's different, but I like him. So that's what I sort of learned from it all. But I think for Dad, I think there were times when it was perplexing, and maybe that was the bit that was too much. But I really put it in the book because at one point, I remember he was giving me some breakfast. I was getting ready for school, and he gave me breakfast. And we're talking about something. He went, well, you can never have too much love. You can never have too much love. You can never give too much love either. He said, you can never run out of love. It doesn't, it doesn't, you know, it's not like oil or something it runs out. It's you know, you can, it's infinite. You can love radio and you can love television. You can love your mum and you can love your sister and you can love your neighbours. It doesn't matter. There's plenty to go around.
So you never felt that you were unloved or misunderstood. You were quite celebrated at home by the sounds of it.
To an extent, I think, yes. I think sometimes, though, if I'd lay the table in a very elaborate manner, my dad would be like, where are we going to put everything? What's this? Why have we got... Why have we got all these napkins? Yes.
Where does that come from, that love of cutlery, Tom? Because it does feature quite a lot.
Well, do you know what? Like, that DNA journey, I don't know if any of your listeners can relate, but that DNA journey uncovered the fact that on my grandfather's side... about 200 years ago, my family were all footmen in a house in Ireland. They were all butlers and things. And I've always sort of had a feeling that I wanted to be a butler. Always liked to go to a bit. Always like Remains of the Day and Downton Abbey, that sort of thing. So I don't know if it's genetic, actually.
Passed down through the years.
Table settings, yeah. Yeah, it's in the family.
Because you spent your pocket money, as you say, not just on cutlery, but like, didn't you get like a set of fish knives or something? I mean, very specific cutlery.
Well, I was always obsessed with, I would see things on television. I'd be like, well, what's that? And where does that go? Why have they laid the table like that? And so I researched it by getting books out of the library. Because back then you couldn't just tap it into your phone what you wanted to know. You had to sort of go through loads and loads of books and you might not find out about things. And then you just sort of had to keep, reading, and maybe one day you'll find out. But I don't know why I was just fixated on this idea of like there's a specific type of cutlery which is different to all the other cutlery, like different to the normal cutlery we had, but it's specifically for things like the fish course of a formal meal. And I don't know why I've just loved the idea of that. So I've saved up my pocket money, and when my mum worked in the Army and Navy, which is a shop, not a branch of the military, I used her discount to purchase cutlery from there.
Well, you talked about how your dad responded to you and your quirks. What about your mum?
Well, I think she quite liked it. She quite liked the idea of kind of having this kind of eccentric son that she could use conversationally. Like, oh yeah, go on. Because from the age of about three, I would just start talking to old people. And I would just love pensioners as well. We'd always like go wandering over and have a full conversation. They'd be like, we don't know where he's from, and my mum would be like, oh yeah, well, you know him, he's always like, we don't know where we got him from. And I think mum liked it, really. But then sometimes she would be, if it was a bit too much of a fuss, it was making a mess around the house, she wouldn't like it. If I was getting all the cutlery out, oh, you're not doing all that now, are you? You're not getting all that out now.
Then it was too much.
Yeah.
You said at times you felt like it was too much to ask your straight friends to come to gay bars with you, which must have put a real barrier up in terms of opening up the social circles for you in which you felt you belonged.
It took me a long time to have other queer friends, really, I think. I did have moments when I did, but I think the thing is, I don't know if there are any queer people who can relate to this, is that there aren't that many of us. I think there are more of us now, more people are more sort of open and talk about things. But when I was growing up, I did feel like the only gay in suburbia. And so growing up, I'd meet people and I'd do like youth theatre things or things like that, and I'd be like, oh, I bet everyone will be gay here and I'll finally be at home, and no one was gay. And so it took me a long time. Wherever they were,
on the fringes of a great city, and you can't find another gay in your suburban village.
Couldn't meet them, Kate. Couldn't meet them. Wow. Couldn't find them, because it was before the internet as well, really, when I came out. It was around, but it wasn't, you know, and things like Grindr came along a bit later, but it was Grindr was quite I think it changed things for a lot of people, because and I think nowadays people don't realise how difficult it was to find other gays.
So anybody that doesn't know what Grindr is, It's Tinder for the LGBTQ plus community, right? But
I think essentially that's a good way of describing it. Yeah.
But I mean, that's probably do you use it to form deep and meaningful relationships, or is it used as an opportunity? You know, I mean, it depends on how people choose to use it. In much the same way as Tinder, actually, some people look for love, others look for
something less than love, a brief form of love,
just something quick and easy. Just 20 minutes of
fun. I think that's the world over, isn't it? It's horses for courses. You pay your money, you take your choice.
But I think because it's associated with fast sex, if you like, people overlook the fact that actually it binds people together in a way that no other app or platform did at that time. It was really important to young men and women like yourself.
I think so. Because I would try and go to you'd see in films, because that was the only reference point to know how to go about meeting people. Because when I was growing up as a teenager, when all the straight people were learning how to form relationships and date and get their heart broken or get rejected and then deal with that and then all that stuff, I had to be completely silent because it wasn't that I didn't know any other gay people. It was just you weren't allowed to talk about, the teachers couldn't talk about it with you. There was no education about being queer, and to talk about it was so shameful because there was so much homophobia. Everyone freely sort of talked about how they, in my experience, just didn't like gay people, didn't support gay people. It was really hateful, really, and so it just meant that I just kept everything locked up and in a small little box inside and hoped that no one noticed. I think they probably did by the fact that I was wearing a top hat, but nonetheless. It was a very strange time. So coming from that and then being in my 20s and going, well, how do you do this? How do you meet people? I'm sort of away from school now. I can be my own person. But I had no tools really to meet people. I didn't know socially how to, in films and stuff, people seem to just go to a gay bar, wherever that was, and then suddenly meet someone and be in a relationship or something would happen. But my experience was, you watch Queer as Folk. It's about a guy who goes out in Manchester and immediately meets this very handsome guy and has this kind of whirlwind romance, and then he meets all these other queer people through them. My experience was I went to a gay bar on my own and stood in the corner with a drink and no one talked to me, and I read some magazines that they had for free, and then I went home. I mean, I may as well have just sat on a bus. But it was, I mean, it sounds very tragic, but I think I didn't know how would you go and talk to a stranger? I didn't have any confidence to do that. So, but anyway, I'm sounding like I'm self-pitying, really, but it was...
Not at all. What you're doing
I knew, I was aware of it.
You're highlighting and mirroring what it was for young queer people at that time. And to be sat around listening to people speak with sort of, hateful tones about who you are must have been really difficult, actually. And you must have felt that you were too much and you just wanted to shrink into your top hat.
Well, yes, I spoke like a rabbit, like a magician's rabbit. I think it was like that. And I think it's important to acknowledge, because a bit like we're saying about the pandemic, when things move on, people go, oh, yeah, we're fine now. What's the problem? And that is brilliant that things have changed now. But then I think we still carry those feelings. They don't disappear.
You've got scar tissue from it, right? Emotional or otherwise.
Well, I suppose so. Yes, I suppose that's what people would call it now. But yes, that's it. Yes, exactly. Well, I suppose so. But I think it's just important to talk about it as well, because if other people have had similar experiences, I always think it's important to talk about it, because we are discouraged from, being honest about our feelings and stuff. So I think it's good to have it out there. It doesn't.
You've got to give it to social media and the internet in so many ways. It cures so many of those ills, doesn't it? In as much as at least people can connect and find their tribe, whatever that is.
Yes, I think whether it's cutlery or whether it's gays, I mean, it's it's there for you. So, yeah. And I sometimes say, that a lot of the time I think the internet can be quite a spiky place. And I sometimes say that I do think the people who comment on social media are often the people who in the old days would have turned up at a public hanging. At the same time, there are lots of good people on there as well as the sort of more aggressive, hateful people. So,
But that's everywhere, isn't it? I think sometimes Twitter, for example, just feels like you know, kicking out time after a buy one, get one free session at Wetherspoons, and everyone's having a fight in the car park and they don't even know what they're fighting about. They're just fighting. That's Twitter for
it
me.
It does have that. Yeah, it does have that. Yeah, it does have that. And not making sense exactly like that. That's
does
the way
have
that
to make sense. It's just, I'm just saying stuff, all right? Like, okay.
Exactly bye. That. Like, if ever, as a stand up, you'll often be in like gigs or, you know, comedy clubs where you're sober because you're performing, and there'll be people who've had a drink and they come up and they talk to you and they don't make any sense. I mean, I don't mind having a drink, but so, you know, you forget that when you are drunk, people don't make any sense at all. They just want, like you say, just say stuff, and they'll be like, I just want to say, I liked your set. And you're like, thank you very much. No, I'm not saying that. Just listen to me. And you're like, I am listening to you. I just want to say I liked your set. And like, well, thank you. No, don't just say thank you. Like, I don't know what you want.
Just say nothing. Just let me speak at you. That's what they want.
Yeah.
Well, my favourite ones is can I have a picture with you? I ain't got a clue who you are, but my missus thinks you're great. So where would
that's
you like
so
a photo?
Funny.
I'm like, and then they stand that's there so while you're awkwardly handling, like, you know, the camera and everything. You stand there and he goes, I still don't know who you are. Brilliant. I haven't got a
they
clue who you
it.
Are either.
That's so funny. I have
this
exactly the same thing. But it's, and I'm generalising, but it is usually blokes who do that, as though they, in my experience, it's blokes who do
people.
That. And drunk people. Blokes will be like, oh, my mum loves you. My mum thinks you're great. And it's like, what's your mum's name? And they'll be like, Bernard, you know, like, you know, it's sort of, you know, like they'll be sort of, they won't, they, it will, I think they do know who we are. They just don't want to say,
of course,
hello, I like you. Because it's sort of a weakness, I suppose.
It's an odd one, isn't it? Because it would never occur to me to go and prod somebody and go, I haven't got a clue who you are. You know, I just wouldn't do it.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
This episode is sponsored by Sky and the release of their gripping new drama, True Detective Night Country, which, let me tell you, has fast become my new TV obsession. And it's come at just the right time. The nights are long, it's cold outside, and my social batteries desperately need a bit of a recharge. So the return of one of the best and, dare I say, classiest dramas out there is like music to my ears. Now, you may have seen the first three seasons of True Detective. It's a brilliant American crime anthology and has previously starred the likes of Matthew McConaughey, Woody Harrelson, Colin Farrell, Stephen Dorff. But this, the fourth instalment, is a whole new story. We find Oscar winner Jodie Foster yeah, actual Jodie Foster and boxing phenomenon turned acting superstar Kaylee Reese, who's brilliant. The pair of them are in Alaska. They're heading up an investigation into the disappearance of eight scientists who operate an Arctic research station, and they have inexplicably vanished without a trace. Oh, and there's a severed tongue lolling about on the floor. Now, this all takes place quite literally during the longest night of the year in Ennis, Alaska, where locals live in total darkness for 67 days. Can you imagine? During the frozen winter months, hence the title, True Detective, Night Country. Now, to solve the case, we have grizzled lead detective Liz Danvers, played just note perfectly by Jodie, and Detective Evangeline Navarro, played by Kaylee. And they are thrown together to find out what happened to these men as they dig into the extraordinary haunted truths that are buried underneath the ice. So is it any good? Is it any good? Does Dolly Parton sleep on her back? It's fantastic. It had me from the first 10 minutes. It's that good. It's one of those rare shows that stays with you as you wait for the next episode to drop, whilst all the while kind of playing along and trying to figure out where on earth the plot is going to go next. And let me tell you, I haven't got it right so far. In fact, this one is really hard to call because it becomes a bit kind of supernatural at times. So you really won't see what's coming. And it's not just me that thinks so. The show's received rave reviews across the board. And because this season brings a whole new cast and story, you don't need to have watched any of the previous seasons before you chuck on the popcorn, get your feet up and tune in to Sky Atlantic. So just dive in. And my DMs are open for any discussions on possible plot twists and your thoughts as to what on earth could possibly be going on. True Detective Night Country is available exclusively on Sky TV, with new episodes dropping weekly on Sky Atlantic. Oh, you're in for a treat.
What happened in the last case you worked with Navarro?
That was good. Until it wasn't. Never too late. There was nothing we could do.
Before we move off of the theme of too much, you do talk an awful lot about your upbringing, your family, especially your dad, and having lost your dad. The one thing that you say is that it's almost too much to comprehend his loss. And I think so many people who have lost a loved one will really resonate that with that. How are you finding working your way through life with a big dad-shaped hole in it?
Oh, it's funny you say that, because it was 2 years just gone. And I think, you know, it of course it does get easier. And I think for me, when it happened, it was that's strange to say unexpected, because he was 80 years old, but it was a heart attack and it was very quick. And I think that shock that you have if you lose someone like that, then that stays with you. Just the dealing with the shock, really, and just kind of going, okay. And it's been the longer thing. It's been sort of dealing with the emotion of it. And I still, like the other day, I was changing phone contracts, and it all comes down to technology. But I realized I had voicemails, and I was worried I would lose them. I'd not listened to them, actually. And I was sort of emailing them to myself. You can do that, it seems. As I did, obviously, press play, and it played. And I hadn't heard his voice since he died. I don't think I had. And that was very strange. And I got very emotional about that. And so you sort of think, well, it does abate the unbearable sadness does abate, or you distract yourself from it, whatever. But then it does sort of flash back. And I think being in that state where sadness can knock you sideways at any point is a new way of living. And so, but I don't, you know, you never get over it, I suppose, but you do. And people say, like, but you find ways to cope. And I don't know if I've done that either, to be honest. You just carry on and go, well, there we go. We did another thing, or another day went by. And
then, do you think you've subconsciously carved out moments for yourself where you can feel like you're with your dad? I know that you've become a very keen gardener. He loved his garden. You've started to replicate some of the stuff that he did in some ways. Does that keep him?
Yes, close? I think that does to an extent. Yeah, certainly in the first kind of 6 months or so, I felt that. Now I feel like, if anything, I think I've probably sort of thrown myself into things in a way that's sort of, I've tried to distract myself from it. So I think that I do even now have to make time to sort of have space and feel things, because otherwise the world is designed, again, with technology as well. So we've always got something to distract ourselves with. You've always got a social media.
You've got to sit with it sometimes, haven't you? You've just got to feel
it. Exactly. Just to feel things, which is, again, sort of, I don't know what that means, but because people will be like, very, very nicely when dad died, people will be like, be kind to yourself, be kind to yourself. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? We've got to phone the coroner in a minute. We've got to organise a funeral. I don't know what sausage rolls, how many sausage rolls we need to order. You know, it's that sort of thing comes in. So the idea of be kind can sometimes feel like a bit of a...
I think, though, it's when people are saying that to you, if they've got experience of it themselves, they know that those first couple of months really are just adrenaline filled. You don't allow yourself to actually live with what the reality of grief is for many months, and then it really hurts. And that's when everybody else has gone back to their lives and they're not checking in anymore. And you feel alone with your grief.
Yes, exactly. I suppose that's it, really. And I think it is the sort of long term feeling that it kind of sits with, that comes to sit with you. That's the thing. And the sort of it is unbearable, really. I suppose that's what it is. It's just it is unbearable. But as we all, that's the human condition, isn't it? Yeah, it is too much. Mm-hmm. It's too much. Thank you for bringing back the name of the book. I suppose that was the thing, really. It's too much. Yeah, it's too much to bear. So
and it felt like the words for that book, Tom, felt like, obviously you wrote it through two very different stages of your life, one with your dad in it, one without. It felt almost like, and you tell me if I've read this correctly, that those words just fell onto the page. They fell out of you.
Yes, that's true, really. Yeah, I had some diary entries I sort of went back to explore, because I wanted to go back into the past and sort of see those, look at myself in at the times of my life when I'd kind of gone away or gone traveling or gone to work abroad and tried to get away from my family, get away, you know, try and work out who I was in the world on my own. And I explored that, but essentially I was sort of just sort of going through it live on the page. And I sort of found myself, actually, the bits that seemed to have resonated with people the most are the bits where I sort of just included some diary entries, really, that I was doing that week, and like the old just feelings and just how incidental things will happen, and someone will pop in to collect their keys that they'd lost, that they'd forgotten here, or something, a delivery would come, but at the same time, you then sort of dealing with this huge kind of sort of situation. But I think it's symptomatic of the world, really, that we don't get a chance to sit with our feelings.
No, but when you write a book. When you write a memoir, you're forced to go and revisit seismic moments in your life, difficult, uncomfortable moments in your life, right? I think that in itself is a really good therapy. I mean, even when you go to your first book and you talk about the shame that was attached to feeling like, you know, you didn't fit in. You were the square peg in the proverbial round hole at school. You were this flamboyant, young, gay man in a world full of people that just didn't get you. And gosh, you know, that must be quite therapeutic to work through that. Also really helpful to leave for the next generation. Because imagine if you'd had that book as a 14-year-old boy.
Yes, I suppose that would have been helpful. Yes, I did feel that. And I did feel like, actually, as well, we don't always get space to quantify our experiences. So you go, do you know what I mean? We're all sort of just like, yes, let's get through it.
Yeah.
On to the next thing. Oh my God, I need some more milk. I need to,
I need an urn for the garden.
the urn is arriving today. That sort of thing. You know, the normal practical things that everyone deals with. And then I was very aware that I got a chance to think about like things in my teenage years, like bizarre things I would do, and like kind of experiencing bullying and then my response to it, rather than stand up to the bullies, was it wasn't a direct response, but there was a school cabaret and I decided to do Julie Walters' monologue from Alan Bennett's Talking Heads, which for no reason, I just felt I had to do it. Just felt drawn to it. Never had that sort of teenage kind of, you know, you're like, this is the thing I need to do. I'm upset. And I've always loved ever since. And I've been obsessed with Alan Bennett and his writing, but it was peculiar for a suburban comprehensive school cabaret night to have, 13-year-old come out dressed as Julie Walters in the monologue Her Big Chance, if any of your listeners know it, where without realizing the character has found herself in a porn film without realizing. So again, very complex.
You're 13. It's Bromley.
I'm about 13. It's Bromley.
Your dad's just clocked off a shift as a coach driver, and here you are.
Here I was. I'd been lent some stiletto boots, which I'd never had any chance to walk in because I was too scared to wear them anywhere else. So I just wore them on the stage. But it was eccentric, yes. And I think some of the parents were like, oh, well, that was interesting. But I think they really wanted us just like a sort of... maybe a clarinet recital of Send in the Clowns at best.
But, you know, when you go back and rewrite those moments, you learn a lot from them, don't you? And they say, you know, now the big thing this year is journaling in terms of people.
Oh, yes.
Mental health professionals are recommending to everybody. If you do nothing else, if you don't go and see a therapist, if you don't ever dip your toe in some cold water, just journal, right? Just write stuff down because it's transformative. And
And apple cider vinegar. And apple cider vinegar seems to be the big thing. The two big things.
The buzzwords of 24. No, God forbid. But also, I think we're programmed to expect, like, if you journal, right, so you spend, you know, 20, 30 minutes writing three pages, and it's supposed to be pleasurable, a release, not necessarily, right? It's about dumping down your feelings. And sometimes they are awkward. You are uncomfortable. You should feel uncomfortable. I think we think that mental well-being and wellness is all about feeling good. And actually, I think sometimes it's just about feeling.
That's very good. That's very good advice, Kate. Yes, because I think there's always that thing of, like, people suggest that the opposite of depression is happiness, whereas actually the opposite is usually action. And anxiety? The opposite of anxiety is often knowing that you have the tools to deal with any situation you're presented with. Like, that's the opposite of anxiety.
That kind of self-belief. That I can work this through. Yeah.
That was suggested to me recently.
We must stop expecting to feel good about, you know, like, you go, oh, but meditation. Well, I'm crap at meditating. I can't focus on anything. You know, all I can do is this, that, and the other. Well, that's still meditation. You're still sat with those uncomfortable feelings. That in itself is tuning everything else out, right?
That's so good. And every time I've spoken to anyone who's like because I was a bit skeptical at first, like mindfulness and that. I just sort of thought it's just breathing and thinking about your legs. And then I realized, when speaking to people, that everyone's the same. Like, I did, I went to a little retreat actually last week, okay? I did I did cold water immersion. I'd like that. Went swimming in a pond. It was 2 degrees. It was not.
Do you know what? It's not nice to do in the moment, but you do not feel good afterwards, right?
It's like everything, isn't it? After the event, it's something to be smug about, but in the moment, you'd do anything to get out of it. But,
I think that's true of everything, with maybe the exception of sex, yeah.
True, Kate, true.
If you're not enjoying that in the moment, you're doing it with the wrong person.
True. Okay, I'll give you that.
I'm going to give you sex, thanks.
That's not what I meant. But the cold water immersion was very good. And then the same person was doing like a sort of how to, like, being in a sauna. This group of us in a sauna, and she was like doing a thing with a towel. Have you ever been in a sauna?
No.
It's very European. They whip a towel around and it really builds the heat up. So we're all sat there like sort of slightly hyperventilating. And she's like, just go on a journey. We're going to go on a walk down to the farm. Just imagine that walk. And I was like, all I could think of was like, I'm so hot. How's this going to end? Oh God. And then afterwards, I was like, I don't think I did that right. I couldn't concentrate on that walk to the farm. And she was like, oh, no one can. Don't worry about it. So, and you go, the world is presented as everybody being so smug and in control. But in truth, we're all just as much of a untidy mess.
Yeah. And also, you know, not everything's going to work for you, but you might have found something on that retreat that you can bring home and put into your daily, weekly life that's really going to help. Because I think if you go in there thinking, oh, in this hour, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to feel phenomenal at the end of it. Or you could just go, for me, you know, I just go, oh, brilliant. It's an hour where nobody can call me. And
yeah,
the word mum.
That's it,
yeah. Excellent. I'm just going to lie down. And anything beyond that is a bonus.
That's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. Well, yeah, because like I say, so it's so easy just to fill our moments with like, I'll just look at the headlines on the BBC website, or I'll just I'll just scroll on that for a couple of minutes, and then you realize you're on there for hours and just going, I'll just look at that shop I like today. I wonder if they've got any new stock in. I do need to buy a thing. I'm sure that would make me happy.
Do you know what? In 20 years' time, we'll all be going, do you remember how we used to scroll so much? It was like smoking a crack pipe. It was so bad for us.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah. But by then, we'll all be so mindful. We'll all be constantly.
So zen.
We'll be so zen. We'll be constantly in an ice bath. We'll be just living in ice baths.
Exactly. I want to go back in time with you now, Tom, if that's okay, for my next question for you, and give you the opportunity to bring something old into the new. You have always been drawn to Victorian and Edwardian times, like phenomenally so. So if you could steal some of the very best ways that the Edwardians and the Victorians lived and then insert them into our daily lives now, make them a staple in terms of how we live in 2024, what would you bring back and why?
I think it would be something like regular meal times. And I know I talk about formality, and I'm talking about the upper classes when I talk about it, I suppose more than the working people, but in those eras. But the idea of having breakfast, lunch, maybe a cup of tea or an afternoon tea.
Slice of cake and a biscuit.
Yeah, I don't think they were always having like the multi-tiered sort of fancy hotel experience. But I think
a slice of fruit loaf.
Maybe I had a dream about Soreen. Gosh, where did that come
from? I love Soreen with loads of butter.
That's what the dream was about. What a strange dream to have.
Soreen.
Why was I dreaming about Soreen? Funny.
I love that you call it Soreen. I've always called it Soren.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I think it's European, isn't it?
No, I think I'm wrong. I think you're right. This is much more fancy.
It makes it sound like the name Doreen, which is my nan's. My nan's mobile hairdresser. Yeah, who used to come round. Do my nan's hair in the kitchen. Yeah. But the idea of a slightly more paced life, I don't know if it was as ideal as it seems, but just I think a slightly more pace. Oh, and actually talking about the loss of my dad, what I did realise is that idea of Victorian mourning, I quite liked, actually, because, not to make everything about death here, but even in the fullness of life, we live in the shadow of death. But anyway, enjoy your day, everyone. Thanks for listening. They would have like a 2 year, some or longer sometimes, but a quite prescriptive period of mourning, which I've heard people say, well, how ridiculous to put an arbitrary amount of time on it. And I thought, well, no, because it gives you beats to go, you know, if it was like the immediate aftermath, everything, like the pictures would be draped in black and the mirrors would be covered and everyone would be wearing black and veils and very much in carrying things.
There's a uniform to it, right? You understand that person is yeah. living through a sadness. So you temper your behaviour towards them accordingly.
I sort of wanted to wear like, you know, like I think until like the... Well, footballers still do it, like a black armband.
Yeah.
I sort of did want to wear that. I didn't, but I sort of thought I wanted to wear that just so people on a tube would go, oh, give them a break. That's just grieving.
Do you want to sit down?
You're right. Oh, I've lost someone recently. You know, that sort of thing, which I think is nice, rather than the age we live in, which I think is like, oh, no, it's so big. You know, we're celebrating the life, which is lovely in a funeral or, service at the end of a life. To go, oh yeah, we're celebrating their life. But at the same time, I think that's quite difficult. I find that quite difficult when people are like, don't wear black. They didn't like black. Wear bright colours and we're celebrating. I'm like, okay, so now I've got to be happy. And, you know, I feel like
Christopher Biggins at my own father's funeral.
Yes. Suddenly I'm... yes.
That's all right.
Why do I look like why am I dressed as a pantomime dame?
Yeah, I get it.
I think there's something about that kind of like acknowledging.
Because I think in other cultures, they grieve in a way that is far more helpful to the human psyche. You know, it goes on for days. They sit around, they talk, they share, they grieve, they wail. They don't hide their emotions. There's no buttoned up, stiff upper lip. You know, it's, you know, yeah. I think there is a lot to be said for that because you don't get over those losses in a day. There is an expectation that once the wake's done, it's like, right, off we go. Here we are then. You know, reset. No, No.
Yes, I think, yeah, having that space as well, just to, yeah, just to kind of allow to be sad or allowed to feel, like we say. I think that's something that they did quite well in the olden days.
What about the way that we dress? Because clearly you're holding on to a lot of the formality of Edwardian and Victorian dressing. I don't imagine that you've got a Primark tracksuit in any of your wardrobes.
No, I have got... Well, I did get a hoodie a little while ago. I don't mind telling you. And I quite like it, but it still... It feels like... even that, I wear it as a... I like to wear it as a formal thing. Like to go, oh, I'm wearing my hoodie today. It's my hoodie uniform. It's my relaxing uniform. But I do like... Yes, I suppose I do. I have talked about it before. I do like a bit of starch. I like a starched collar. I like... you know, some of the old-fashioned tailoring was very becoming on people.
Mm. And complimentary, actually. You know,
yes.
As for a woman, I think terribly uncomfortable at times. I mean, I don't mind telling you, Tom, the first thing I do when I get home is take my bra off. You know,
sure,
let them breathe.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I can imagine
bra,
that can be very
happy days. Yeah?
Yes. Sure.
So I don't know how much of those bodices I could have dealt with, but
yes.
My God, they made you look good.
That's the thing, isn't it? They did look good. And I think as well, like bustles and things like that, it's interesting that now people. I'm not an expert on this. Maybe you can advise me. But people have, like, butt lifts and things, don't they?
Totally. Yes, they do. Yes,
so
they do.
People... But when you think, is that sort of similar to when the Victorians used to wear a bustle at the back of their dress? Is that sort of...
The bustle was also there to accentuate the waist. So, you know,
to celebrate
all of those fabulous female curves.
Ah, right. Yeah, there you go. See, yeah, right.
But it's also... It's all wrong. I mean, I don't know if this stat still holds true today, but I worked on a show years ago... just a pilot, so it never made it to the screen, called From Waist to Waif. And it tells the story of how the British woman is 7 inches bigger everywhere than she was during these times of the Victorian Edwardian era.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Probably because they didn't have anything to eat as well. Like, we were sort of...
Processed food's probably got a lot to answer for, I would have thought. Yeah, because we all started to get bigger around the... What it was the introduction of household gadgets like the washing machine and the Hoover. So we stopped working out as much, because before that, everything had to be done by hand. So you would go beat your rugs on the. Remember, you know, rugs and your washing machine. You'd do it. You know, there was no washing machine. There was no spin dryer.
No.
You had to do it all by hand.
Oh,
sweep
I see.
Your doorstep, all that stuff. So that then that a long time. What is the Industrial Revolution really? The household equipment, the car, and processed foods and freezers. You could freeze.
Oh, I see. Is that right? Oh, well, I should get out my carpet sweeper. Maybe I could lose a few pounds. I could get it. Yeah.
Do you remember the carpet sweeper? My nan had one. You just rolled it around. It didn't plug in or anything.
My nan got one. My mum had a budgerigar, but she swapped it with her neighbour to get a carpet sweeper. So my mum came home one day and then Billy the budgerigar and the carpet sweeper. Yeah, it was a yellow carpet sweeper, actually, so that was... You know, some comfort.
I remember them so well. If you don't remember what they are, then congratulations, you're very young.
Different times.
Third and final question, and hopefully a quick one for you. You're about to head out on tour, and my goodness, you are going the length and breadth of the country. And I wondered, as you get older and more emboldened in your choices, what does life on the road look like for you now? What are your requirements by way of a rider that maybe a younger, less refined comic would expect?
Well, this is sort of my second tour.
Is it really? Is it really?
Yes, it's gone on. Well, I'm going back on to the same tour. So we started in February last year and it continues till June this year, which is a great privilege.
And ironically, it's called Completely. So it's kind of, you know, completely running.
Completely.
And, probably completely will never end.
Yes, completely everywhere.
Yes.
And I love doing it, but I have realised what I need, I suppose, a bit more. And it is largely things like some herbal teas, maybe a little glass of Prosecco for after the show. What else do I like? I try and be healthy, but I fail. Because I think when I'm on the road...
So hard on the
road. It's so hard because you sort of go, oh, I fancy a treat. I'm a bit tired. Or, let's go and have a burger rather than oh, let's have some melon slices. So,
a pot of mango, you say? No, thanks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Healthy things like that. Even though they're absolutely delicious, and when I do have them, I really like them. But I've been told I've got to get my cholesterol down. But still, it's one of those things. I'm like, tomorrow. That's a gig for tomorrow, mañana. But yeah, those sorts of things. Whereas before, I'm trying to be more mindful of what I'm eating, I suppose. Yeah.
Sarah Millican said that she always bonded with you from the get-go because whilst everybody else was kind of propping up the bar and living a far more hedonistic existence on the road, you two would be Googling which hotels had, you know, a pillow menu
yes.
or a decent carpet that wasn't sticky underfoot.
Yes, I mean, Sarah has always been a very good friend to me, and really, before I was touring, she took me as her support on her tour, which was a really wonderful experience.
She's good. She's good. Very Sarah, generous. Isn't she? She's good at elevating others.
Yeah, she was very generous to me. Yeah. Yes, that was very much the ethos, was to not feel like you have to be in the bar and not feel like you have to sort of be socializing. It's quite nice just to go to a hotel room and sleep on a nice pillow. And some people do take their own pillow, which I've never quite stretched to, because I always think it'd be quite cumbersome to travel with. But more and more I have got to thinking, actually, I might benefit from that, just because as you get older, you know, you notice things.
I take a packet of coffee and a cafetiere, because I can't I can't do the Nescafe sachet things first thing. I need something a bit more kind of rocket fuel-esque.
Oh, okay. And a cafetiere will give you that. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's...
And sometimes you get those machines, but they're always lukewarm, the coffee, and I can't do lukewarm coffee either.
I find some of those machines can be like that, certainly. Yeah. So, yeah, I know what you mean.
They're a bit all fur coat and no knickers. They look great, but they don't really deliver what you need.
I know what you mean, Kate. I know exactly what you're saying. They're a bit, it's a lot of foam. But I go, I don't know if there's anything actually in this.
Yes, exactly. Is there any... Yes, why am I not awake properly?
Whereas a cafetiere, well, but you have to be careful with a cafetiere. You can't have it too late in the day. You can't, I would say, don't have a cafetiere after 12.
I can go to bed with a fresh coffee and sleep.
I can with certain coffees, Kate, but then the other day I had an Americano after dinner and I went to sleep for a bit, woke up at 3, couldn't get back to sleep till 9 a.m.
Oh, and then you're ruined, aren't you? It's jet lag.
It's like jet lag, yeah. Yeah, days where we're ruined after that. So,
when you're looking for booking hotels, that becomes another obsession for the comic on the road, doesn't it? It's like, what's that hotel then? Where is that? Has it got a gym? What are the things that you really look for?
Pictures. If they put a picture up of a room, of their room, going, this is one of our rooms, and it's got like fresh flowers and flower and like petals on. No, I'm like, no, because your room isn't that. You've dressed up a room to take a photograph in it, but I know when I go there, it won't look like that. It will look really bare, and it will look like you haven't got enough things in it, and it will look like it hasn't been thought through. So for a photograph, you think you can smoke screen it by putting a big bunch of flowers on the bedside table and you know, like a wine cooler with champagne on the side. And I'm like, well, no, your room isn't going to be like that when I get there. It's going to not have those things. So why are you hiding it? That's a trick I've noticed. So I'm quite discerning. I think whatever pictures they've chosen to put up on their website are the ones I judge them on. I judge their choices.
I do a compare and contrast. I'm a bit Martin Lewis about this. I'll go on TripAdvisor and look at other people's pictures. And then you're like, that's when you can sniff out a rose petal bath from the bollocks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there is a lot of that, isn't there? Like a slightly badly designed bathroom. Too much space in a bathroom. I don't like that because... I don't know why. I just sort of feel like a bathroom
that's too much space in a bathroom.
In certain hotels, if there's too much space, I'm like, why have you got so much space here? Why? You haven't thought about it. You haven't planned the space out properly. And, you know, when you stay in hotels a lot, you start to notice a lot of things and you go, why is there no space? You've given me a trendy sink, which looks like a bowl on a work surface. Okay, you've gone for the trendy option, but you haven't really considered what people want when they're traveling. There's no space either side of the sink, so suddenly my wash bag is sort of balanced precariously on the cistern.
Yeah, that really annoys me.
And I'm like, no, I don't want to have to leave my toothbrush on the floor of this
Or near a toilet.
Yeah. I don't want, and I know that sounds, people are like, so grand. But often there'll be no consideration of that. And I go, no, that's really important.
Yeah.
But it's not important in the scheme of things. I know that too. But...
Do you know my other bugbear now is I can't do, I think it's because of my failing eyesight. There are certain chains of hotels that are just so dark. You can't see anything. I can't put my makeup on at the best of times. I can't do it in the frickin' dark. Do you know the ones I mean?
I know exactly the ones you mean.
Yeah.
Yes, they are very dark in those places, exactly. I wonder sometimes that some of those places doing them, making it dark so that you can't see where they haven't cleaned.
This is exactly it, right? So when I was younger, I worked in nightclubs and I've seen those places with the big lights on, yeah? And once you've seen everything God. With the big lights on, it makes you want to vomit. So I was saying, God. This place looks great because I can't see where I'm going. But if I put the big lights on, what's on that carpet? I always think about the carpets.
And mold in the shower. Oh, I can't do it. I can't.
Necessary.
You know when it's that. Like there must be a way you could
There's
do that.
There's products to clear that.
Yeah. There's products to clear that, or just change the mastic.
There you
get someone in to do. If I ran the world, Kate. I mean, we've covered all the big
Tell
topics.
You what, with advice like that, Nick Knowles should start to shake in his caterpillar.
Oh
boots.
My God! Can you imagine if I did that show? I'd be terrible, wouldn't I?
You'd be great. Tom, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute treat to talk to you.
Thank you.
And I you know, wish you the very best. You don't need it because you're all selling like hotcakes. But tickets are available now. People can also download your podcasts, which you do with the lovely Susie Ruffles. And I really would recommend that you read or listen to Tom's two memoirs because they are, well, if I say so myself, rather splendid.
Oh, Kate, thank you for a lovely chat. I've enjoyed it very much.
What a lovely man. Do you know what? I'd never met Tom Allen before. But everyone that I asked about him in the business, not one single person had anything other than just glowing praise for him, and now you can see why. So if you'd like to extend the hour you've just spent with him and spend an evening in Tom's company, what are you waiting for? Tickets for his tour Completely are on sale now. The tour's called Completely, by the way, just in case you thought I was just, you know, waffling. Speaking of which, for more chat with other great guests from the comedy world, we have episodes in our back catalogue with the very funny Rob Brydon, Adam Hills, Daisy May Cooper's in there, Ellie Taylor, Sir Tony Robinson, Kerry Godleyman, Griffiths Jones, Al Murray, Lee Francis, Ed Gamble and James Acaster, and so many more, all waiting for you to just hit the download button. I'll be back on Tuesday with a little something from the cellar, a little midweek amuse-bouche, if you will. Until then, thanks so much for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.